The night may be long and the dark may be deep, but the answers are there to be found. Whether it's the normal, the abnormal, or the paranormal, you're in the right place. Let's go beyond reality.
Anyway, welcome to the beginning of a week. I'm looking forward to getting another week started here as we have a lot of great topics and a lot of great guests scheduled for tonight and the rest of the week. Tonight we'll be talking about Nikola Tesla. This is a man and a topic that for a very long time was quite ignored. And recently, within the last, I don't know, dozen years, maybe 20 years, more and more attention has been given to his accomplishments and his theories and his ideas. And he's starting to get some of the recognition he deserves. And we're going to continue that trend tonight with Tim Swartz. And we're going to talk about his books that relate to Tesla, plus his research that resulted in those books. And find out a little bit more about his work and his, when I say his, I mean Tesla's work and his achievements and everything that he has done. So I'm going to get our guest on the line. We're going to be talking to, again, Tim Swartz tonight about Nikola Tesla. This is going to be a great conversation. Please support the program. Go to patreon.com/Johaw. That's J-O-H-A-W. Tim, welcome back to Beyond Reality. It's really great to have you here with us tonight.
Thank you very much, JB. It's great to be with you tonight.
Let's get people reacquainted with you, because it's been a while since you've been on. You know, we know that you've looked into a lot of different topics, written about a lot of different topics, appeared on TV, radio, whatever it happens to be. You're well-versed in this stuff. But what got you started to begin with? Where did the curiosity come from?
Oh, wow. I first got interested in all of this stuff probably as far back as elementary school, when I was given an assignment. The entire class every week was given an assignment from a little kid's newspaper that Scholastic Books used to put out. And it was an aggregate of the week's headline news. And one time I was given an assignment to write about UFOs. I had never heard about UFOs, could have cared less about UFOs. You know, Indiana boy, I was interested in race cars, Indianapolis 500, things like that. So, you know, I did my little paper and, you know, gave the presentation in front of the class. And then I was pegged from then, from that time on. I was the UFO guy. I was the person who believed in little green man and flying saucers and things like that. But the funny thing that I noticed is over the years that, you know, people would make fun of you to your face, you know, when everybody else was around. But then later they'd come back and they'd say, you know, I don't believe in this stuff, but.
Right.
And it was those buts. You know, they would tell me then stories about, you know, how their house was haunted, or their family saw a UFO when they were on vacation. And that's what really got me interested in this stuff. You know, not so much the stories, but the way that the people would come to me with these stories. The majority, they weren't interested in, you know, publicity or anything like that. They just wanted to tell somebody who would listen to them and not laugh at them, and maybe assure them that what happened to them, or what, you know, continued to happen to them, happens to other people, and they're not crazy. And through the years, I have found time and again, you know, that same kind of situation coming up. You know, people will come up to me, you know, at what I do, like a lecture at a conference or something like that. It's the same situation. You know, they want to tell me this story, that experience that they had, because a lot of people have no idea how to mentally categorize a lot of these things. You know, it's a little bit easier nowadays because of the proliferation of reality television shows that deal with UFOs and Bigfoots and ghosts. It's amazing. But still, there are a lot of people who will have these experiences and their brain doesn't know what filing system to put that in. You know, I saw my dead grandmother standing at the foot of my bed telling me everything was going to be all right. Where do I put that in my head? And after they tell me these stories, a lot of them, they don't want explanations or anything like that. They just want to be heard, and you can see almost like the weight lifted off their shoulders, and they walk away feeling better, because most of the time they can't go and even tell a family member for risk of being laughed at or being called crazy. Oh, you know, family members are the worst when it comes to being made fun of in these types of situations. So, you know, through the years, I have found that probably, 95, maybe more than that, 90% of people have at least one bizarre experience in their life. Most people tend to just try to forget about it and go on with their lives. Other people, you know, they'll chew on it for the rest of their lives, not knowing what to do or what to make of their experience. And really, that's the stuff that just fascinates me about all of this.
But you hit on a very important point in your answer there. When you mentioned the effect of reality television, particularly paranormal reality type television, that is permeating all of the cable networks, it seems.
Right.
And I would have to say that you might agree, and tell me if you do or don't, that it really has been a bit of a paradigm shift.
Oh, it definitely has. I mean, really within, these kind of shows really started to take off. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, we would have shows like In Search Of, you know, with Peter Graves and Leonard Nimoy, and that was about it. You know, later on, there were some other shows. I can't remember the one now. There was a big one that Inside Edition used to produce before the X-Files came out. But really, it was kind of like the X-Files, even though it was a fictional TV show. Kind of got all this stuff started, and then because it's basically cheap to produce these, especially like the ghost hunting shows,
yeah.
or the UFO hunting shows, where everybody has had those stupid camera gears attached to their bodies with the night vision cameras, and everybody would be running around the woods, bumping into trees and screaming every time an owl hooted or something. But it did generate views, and it did get people thinking about the reality of these kinds of experiences, whether it is, you know, ghosts or UFOs or even hunting for Bigfoot. And I think people now are a little bit more likely to accept the possibility that the things that, you know, 10, 20 years ago they'd be laughing, you know, till they fell to the floor about. And so yes, you're right. I mean, you know, it has been a big shift in the acceptance of the paranormal and the unusual.
And I love the fact that you pointed this out as well, because it's always cracked me up a little bit, but I also find a little bit of sincerity, or no, sincerity is not the word, charm, I guess, is the word in these stories. But I frequently will run into people that'll say, usually it's ghost stuff, because that's really what my history has been involved with, but it can be anything. And they'll say, yeah, that's a bunch of garbage, I don't believe in any of that. But when I was 8 years old, I saw my grandfather standing at the end of the bed, and he died 2 weeks earlier. You know, they always have a story. Everybody seems to have a story of some kind.
Right, right. Yeah, that's and that's the funny thing about it, is that they may laugh at other people who talk about these kinds of experiences, but they take their own extremely seriously.
Right.
Most people don't even want to talk about it, but when they do mention it, boy, they get all defensive if somebody turns around and laughs at what they're saying. So, you know, it's I suppose that's just human nature. You know, you believe in the experiences that you have, but other people's experiences, oh well, that's just a load of, you know.
So you developed this curiosity, and you kind of set down a path to get some answers to some really longstanding and maybe what I would consider to be, in many cases, difficult to answer questions. What did you start looking at first? From a professional standpoint, what did you start looking at?
Well, I professionally, it was UFOs. Because when I was in college, I kind of helped support myself by writing articles for UFO magazines. Back in the middle to late 70s, there were still a number of UFO magazines being published. You had Saga magazines, UFO Reports, True magazine had like a quarterly UFO magazine, official UFO. And believe it or not, at that time, these magazines actually would pay you to write articles for them. I mean, it wasn't much, but, for a kid going through college, every little bit helped. From UFOs, I then started writing about ghosts and hauntings because I've had my own personal experiences, which led me to do some feet on the ground investigations on my own of other cases, and so it just kind of spread from there. From then looking into ghosts and hauntings, I started looking into cryptid cases. The place I was going to college had a number of Bigfoot sightings close to the river that divided Indiana and Illinois. So that got me interested in that. And then, when it comes to these kinds of things, it's like crack cocaine, I suppose. it becomes addictive. At least for me, it was. I mean, this was fascinating, and then something else comes up, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is fascinating too. And now, all these years later, it still, all of it is just so fascinating to me. Some people, when they get into these kind of things, they tend to stick with, say, just UFOs or just ghost and hauntings, and really refuse to waver from that path or even consider that there could be an overlap across all of these different types of unusual phenomena. But see, for me, it is completely different. Since I became interested in everything, I began to see that there was this really interesting overlap between, say, like UFOs, ghosts, and even Bigfoot and other types of cryptids. They all seem to be under this big extended umbrella, which a lot of these other investigators who tend to focus only on one subject, they hate it when others come out and say, well, there's some really good evidence that that people who have UFO sightings also have poltergeist experiences in their house, or there's also a Bigfoot sighted in UFO flap areas. And a lot of these researchers will, when they get these types of stories, they either won't include them in their files, or else they'll kind of like edit out some of these other parts of the reports because it doesn't fit within their narrow viewpoint. And I like to approach these subjects with the idea that I'm not here to edit any of this out. I'm going to take it all in and report it as it's given to me, and then let the person who reads it or listens to it decide for themselves.
I have a real fascination with people who report multiple experiences within either a narrow geographic area or a narrow time frame, and I'm not sure if they are the person themselves are acting as some type of paranormal lightning rod that attracts a Bigfoot sighting, a UFO sighting, and a poltergeist experience all within a short period of time, or if they happen to be in a place that is just surrounded by these phenomena. And what are your thoughts on this, Tim? Do you think it's the person, it's the place, or it's some combination of all of the above that makes these multiple phenomena reports seemingly more common than we might think?
I do think that it is a combination of all of the above. Now, saying that, I'll also say that you will have individuals who just really seem to be lightning rods for paranormal activity. Their lives are filled with UFO sightings and ghosts and other weird things, and no matter where they are, where they're living, it's like this phenomena follows them around. The other part of that is that a lot of times this kind of stuff runs in families. If you have somebody who has a lot of UFO, ghost sightings, things like that, chances are one of their parents or grandparents also had similar experiences like that. You know, you see that sometimes in UFO abduction reports, that if you have somebody who complains that they're being abducted, you know, by the little big-eyed grays who come into the bedroom and shove probes up their nose, chances are that this is something that has occurred throughout their family, one branch or the other, for a number of generations. Now, then again, you have people who just kind of stumble across weird activity that seems to be centered over certain areas. There are areas all over the world that are hotspots for UFO and paranormal activity. The funny thing about that is that these hotspots come and go. They may be active for a couple of months, a couple of years, a couple of decades, and then it'll just suddenly stop and maybe move 100 miles east or west, north or south, or just disappear completely. You see this right now. Pennsylvania is a very a big hot spot and has been for a number of years, dealing with all kinds of weird things, UFOs, cryptid creatures, and bizarre cryptid creatures. Things that look like that they've jumped out of the outer limits or something, not just, Bigfoot or things like, dogmen or dogmen with wings or, the screaming devil monkeys is a good one that seems to be going on that from like southern Pennsylvania into West Virginia, Kentucky, places like that, where people are reporting these large chimpanzee type monkeys that just suddenly leap out of the forest and onto their car, but they're like they have rabies or something, just mouthfuls of impossibly long teeth and glowing red eyes, just totally bizarre stuff. I think it's a combination of a lot of different things where people seem to be haunted, but then again, there are haunted locations as well. If you just happen to stumble into the wrong place at the wrong time, you may run into something.
Tim, you got an interest in Nikola Tesla along the way too. What was it about Tesla's story that put it into the same category of everything we just talked about? I mean, we talked about things like screaming devil monkeys or whatever you just said, and Bigfoot and UFOs and ghosts and poltergeists, and now we have Nikola Tesla. How does that fit into this sphere of curiosity that you have?
I used to work for a television station in Dayton, Ohio, in the early 1980s, and one of my jobs was to go to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which is right there next to Dayton, and once every couple of weeks or so, a producer and myself, we would go and check in with the press liaison there to see if they had any anything interesting going on that that we could do a story on, that we could, you know, do a report for one of our newscasts. And Roy Patterson was always, you know, very helpful and always very willing to provide something interesting for us. And one day when we were there, the lieutenant, I think that's what his classification was, you know, he was going through his files trying to find something, and he made this offhand remark. He said, you know, we're doing some research based on the work of that mad scientist Tesla, but I can't really talk about that right now. And then went on, you know, to something else. And at that point, I don't think that I had ever heard of Nikola Tesla before. If I had, it hadn't stuck at that point. But that name, Tesla, mad scientist Tesla, I was like, well, what's that all about? And, of course, it didn't occur to me till after we had, you know, done whatever story on and had left. I was like, okay, who's this mad scientist Tesla that the Air Force is doing experiments based on his work? So I started doing my own research, and fortunately, you know, when you're working for a television station or you know, newspaper or anything like that, you have access to all kinds of great sources. We have a thing called LexisNexis.
Yeah, the research thing.
Yeah. And most people they can't get access to that.
That's right.
The station had paid, you know, good money to allow us to get
it. Wasn't so cheap. That wasn't a cheap service back when it was the only option.
No, it was not. After I had left that station, I looked into, even though I was working for, you know, I started working for another station that didn't pay for that, and I looked into it to see how much it would cost, and I was like, oh, no, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But then that's when I started discovering more about Tesla, and again, this would have been like the early 1980s, and there's still was not a lot of information to be had, mostly from some like electronic journals and things like that. There was a couple of reports from the Getty News Service from the early 40s on Tesla's birthday, because every year before he died, when he had his birthday, he would give like a little press conference, and the local newspaper, New York newspapers, would do a story on him. You know, here's what Dr. Tesla says is, you know, going to happen this coming year, and some of his experiments are going to, you know, produce such and such thing. Other than that, it was very difficult to find any information about the guy, and that just kind of led to, you know, my journey of trying to dig out as much info about Nikola Tesla that I could.
Why do you think that Tesla, and I think I found the same thing to be true, and I hadn't really heard of Nikola Tesla until, I say rather recently, you know, maybe 20 years ago, it started to really show up on the radar, but why do you think he was largely forgotten to history, or maybe not forgotten, but ignored by the storytellers for so long, when it seems to be his contributions were so plentiful and his ideas were so groundbreaking? And we're starting to realize all of that now. So why the shroud over Tesla for so long?
It really is amazing how he had become almost just completely forgotten up until really very, very recently. You know, in fact, there used to be an exhibit in the Smithsonian Institute that attributed the discovery of electricity and the AC current system, along with the AC motor,
mm-hmm,
to Thomas Edison.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, and I mean, it finally, I guess, was taken down probably at the beginning of the 21st century. But up until that time, I guess this display, and somewhere in my files, I have a picture of it, but you should see my files. I think that may be one of the reasons, among many, that Tesla was somewhat forgotten, was that Edison really dominated the whole electrical thing after Tesla's death, because Edison, the light bulb, so naturally if Edison, you could just see how this train of thought would go. Edison invented the light bulb, electricity, Edison, yeah, makes sense. Probably Edison and his heirs, they're not going to dispute that.
Right.
General Electric isn't going to dispute that. But as well, in Tesla's later years, he was always an eccentric person. Not so much when he was younger, but as he grew older, I think that that eccentric side of him that he possibly managed to keep down a little bit when he was younger, as he got older, became more and more predominant in his personality. He became a loner. He did like, as I said earlier, he did like to have his press conferences on his birthday, but people nowadays would say possibly that he sat somewhere on the spectrum. If you know what I mean.
That, right. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Right. He, for instance, he detested pearl necklaces on women. For some reason, it was just like it just sat wrong with him, and he couldn't bear to look at that. He was extremely fastidious. He was a germophobic. His eating utensils, he would always eat at a certain restaurant at the Hotel New Yorker that he lived in, and his knives and forks had to be set in a specific order. Things like that. And so by the time that he was elderly, a lot of his great work had mostly been forgotten about. And so after he passed away, he really just, his name just kind of fell into oblivion. And this, now you have to also remember that Marconi had been awarded the patent to, claiming that he invented radio.
That's right.
Even though it was Tesla, who had previously had several patents along these lines. And it wasn't until after Tesla had passed away that the patent rights were taken away from Marconi and given back to Tesla. But even then, he was already being forgotten about, at least by the general public, because there were a lot of laboratories, especially government-based laboratories, who were continuing to work on things that Tesla had been working on, developing over the years. And of course, that's the other fascinating aspect about Tesla's life, was that even though publicly he was declared a crackpot, a crank, a mad scientist, yet years after he died, there were still all kinds of research and development being done on Tesla's ideas and inventions.
Yeah, that's a fascinating part of his work as well, because it certainly survived his death, and the ideas were valid enough that people continued to work on them, and many are still being worked on today. Let's go back and talk a little bit about Tesla's life before. I know he went to work for Thomas Edison, but was he was he an immigrant to this country? Give us a little bit about his background.
Sure. Well, he was born in 1856 in the what was then the Austro-Hungarian Empire. He was Serbian, so I mean he was born in the area of what used to be called, you know, Yugoslavia,
right,
which is now, you know, split up into a number of different countries. And you know, even at an early age, he showed a real penchant towards science and invention and engineering. And you know, his father was an Orthodox priest and had hoped that Tesla would become a priest as well. And Tesla made a deal with him one time. Tesla had gotten extremely ill once, and his father thought that he was going to pass away. And because he thought that Tesla was going to die, his father said, "Okay, if you live, you know, you can go off to university, and you know, I won't bug you anymore about becoming a priest." Well, Tesla lived, and so his dad allowed him to study in Austria, Hungary, places like that,
right.
Because he excelled so much and impressed his professors. They actually wrote him a letter of recommendation to Thomas Edison, and so then Tesla immigrated to the United States specifically to work for Thomas Edison, and took several of these glowing letters to present to Edison. And Edison at that time had already developed his own electrical power system based on direct current, and he was in the process of putting this together in New York City. The problem with Edison's system was that DC current doesn't travel very far before it has to be stepped up again and then you know, transmitted another block or so. So, you know, every couple of blocks there would be a new transmitter array that would be set up to keep this current going. You know, Tesla approached Edison and you know, "I want to work for you," and Edison hired him. And one of the first things that Edison hired Tesla to do was to fix a power system that was on a yacht of a friend of Edison. That was sitting in New York's harbor. The generator had, I guess, had basically just blown up and had fried the entire electrical system, you know, on this yacht. And when I say yacht, this was a pretty good sized ship. He promised Tesla, and who knows? Everybody reports that this is true, and knowing from what I've read about Edison, it probably was, because he didn't expect Tesla to be able to fix this ship. So he told Tesla that you know, if he got it fixed, that he would give him a bonus of, you know, just an outrageous amount of money, you know, probably the equivalent of about you know, $50,000 today,
right,
or something along those lines. So Tesla went out to this ship and fixed it in a matter of a day or so. It wasn't hard for him at all. And he came back and he said, "Okay, it's all fixed. Where's my money?" And Edison refused to pay him and told Tesla that, "Well, you just don't understand the American sense of humor." And Tesla did not understand the American sense of humor and promptly quit. And that kind of started from that day on the whole war of currents between Edison and Tesla. And you know, for a couple of years, Tesla had to resort to, you know, menial labor, digging ditches and things like that, before he finally convinced some other entrepreneurs that his ideas for the development of the AC motor, and, you know, ultimately what would lead to the whole AC current, which dominates the world now, be able to fund Tesla and to do the proper research to get this stuff going, which was in direct competition, naturally, with Thomas Edison. And because of that, and because basically Tesla won that war, I mean, we have AC current as our main source of electricity throughout the world, not DC, except for batteries and you know, small electrical instruments. Edison didn't like that very well, and he swore that you know, every chance that he would get, he would make Tesla's life miserable, and he did too. I mean, when AC power was building up, excuse me, across the country, and the lines, the generators had been built at Niagara Falls, the lines were being put out across the country, Edison was trying to show that AC current was dangerous and conducted these public spectacles where he would electrocute dogs and other animals, including an elephant.
Elephant, right? Yeah, an elephant. That's a famous, and it's all on film. Or
yes.
He filmed the whole thing. It's rather disgusting display, but that was one of the things he did.
Well, and in fact, the first electric chair, you know, to kill a prisoner, was built by Edison as an attempt to show to the public that Tesla's AC current was extremely dangerous, and that, look, you know, this. We're going to fry these prisoners, these human beings, using AC current. And so, I mean, and you want it coming into your house? You know, how stupid are you? You know, ultimately, though, none of Edison's dirty tricks worked. And Tesla's ideas, when it came to the AC motor and alternating current, did prevail. At least through Tesla's lifetime. I mean, you know, like I said earlier, we still have our electrical grid, our electrical system based on AC current, but Edison's name was still ended up being a lot more well known than Tesla.
It's so bar. Well, I mean, Edison seemed to be a consumer electronics pioneer, in addition to some of this more industrial type stuff. I mean, things that we recognize today as household miracles came from Edison's studios and his work. But I think now might be a good time, Tim, to differentiate, just so people know, we talk about AC and DC pretty freely here because we know what this story is about, but folks might be saying, what does AC/DC mean? What are those? What's the difference between those two? Can you give us a sense of what we're talking about and why the two are different?
Well, a little bit. I mean, I'm not too much of an electrical engineer, but okay, DC stands for direct current, all right? And AC stands for alternating current. But as for, you know, exactly, the idea, you know, for alternating current came to Tesla, and I have to admit, you know, this is a fascinating story and a fascinating aspect about Tesla, and I would be, you know, remiss if I didn't mention this. One of the things that makes Tesla so unique is that when he had an idea for an invention, he would have visions, basically, as he would call them, where he would see whatever it is that he was trying to develop. They would appear, he said, right in front of his eyes. And for his descriptions, they would sound almost like a hologram. He could see this, you know, the item. And, you know, when he first conceived the AC motor, this is what it was. He saw this AC motor appear in front of his eyes. You know, mentally he could turn it around in any direction. It was like 3D. He could take it apart and see all the components. And and that's it was then up to him to actually take this vision and make it a reality. And when it came to the AC motor, it actually worked. Now, let's see. AC motors before Tesla, they were laboratory devices, curiosities. You know, they never ran smoothly because they were poorly designed. And in fact, one of Tesla's professors told him that an AC motor was basically just a perpetual motion device, and to not even about bother with it. Direct current was what everybody was expecting was going to be, the big thing. Direct current motors have one obvious drawback, though. Reversing current direction through magnet windings can happen only with some sort of switching that swaps current direction end for end. This is normally done, from my notes here, by applying power through a pair of stubby contacts called brushes that ride against a spinning rotor shaft against a ring of contacts. Thus, it's always rotating its connections with the brushes, sending current through the rotor windings first in one direction and then the other. So what Tesla conceived is an alternating current that's fed to windings that would create poles that reverse themselves without any mechanical aid. Remains motionless in its fields, and in fact swirling around its interior from one pole face to the next. So I don't know if that's a good explanation to that, but I'll just say that AC current tends to be a lot more efficient, and even though it has a lot higher power, it can travel a lot further than DC, which is really, we now know, is basically better for smaller instruments that don't require the current to travel very far. I don't know if I explained that very well, but
you did, and better than I could have, which is why I let you do it instead of trying to do it myself. We're talking with Tim Schwartz tonight. His website is easy to find. It's conspiracyjournal.com. A lot of books to his credit, including The Lost Journals of Nikola Tesla, Tim R. Schwartz's Big Book of Alien Encounters, Geff the Talking Mongoose, America's Strange and Supernatural History. There's quite a list there, Tim. When we talk about Tesla's early years and his rivalry that developed with Edison, when Tesla had ended up leaving Edison's employ, and he found some money and some backers from other people, and there were some pretty notorious people involved there, weren't there?
Oh yeah. Well, like I said earlier, when Tesla first left the Edison company, he had a pretty hard time of it. He basically did odd menial jobs. Like I said, he even went and dug ditches, and he finally started finding some backers for his ideas. First of all, because Edison was dominating this whole business, and there were other entrepreneurs who were like, we see the potential for money here. We just need to find somebody who can go against Edison's ideas. So some of Tesla's backers were people like J.P. Morgan, John Astor, Lord Rothschild, and W.K. Vanderbilt. These were the people that eventually started paying Tesla to build a laboratory in Manhattan and to start doing the research to take his AC motor and to make it bigger and better. Tesla's idea was that he was going to take these generators and build them at Niagara Falls to generate electricity that could then power the country. Now, you have to remember, I mean, this was in the late 1890s, all right? This sounded incredible to most people.
Right.
You know, okay, yeah, you're gonna harness the falls at Niagara, you know, at Niagara Falls to generate electricity and power New York, Buffalo, places like that. Yeah, you're crazy. J.P. Morgan didn't think he was crazy. J.P. Morgan was willing to put money into this, you know, and this, you know, this would later become the Westinghouse company. And so ultimately, Tesla was right. He was able to build the first electrical generating plant at Niagara Falls. And you have to remember, you know, nobody had ever done this before, with the exception of a smaller scale using DC current by Edison in New York. And when I'm talking about a smaller scale, I mean, you know, just maybe about, these generators were maybe about the size of a desk, all right? I don't know if you've ever been or seen pictures of the Tesla generators at Niagara Falls, but they're huge. They would fill an entire room, just one of them, and there were a number that Tesla and his engineers built themselves based on Tesla's ideas. You know, again, nobody else had ever built anything like this before. So, you know, here is this young upstart who was able to take this this money that had been given to him and build this marvelous electrical generation system at Niagara Falls, using the force of the falls to generate electricity. You know, it had never been done before, and it was just this fantastic thing. One of the ironies about all of this is that the government granted Tesla and Westinghouse the rights to build this plant and to generate the electricity, but the electric lines that would carry this electricity from Niagara Falls, you know, first it was to, you know, places like, you know, Buffalo and New York, but then it went out to, you know, other places. The company that was awarded to build these cables was the Edison Company. And that really, that ended up kind of smacking Tesla in the face, because the Edison Company really put the screws to Tesla and Westinghouse on this. You know, I mean, they charged out the wazoo for these things, and, you know, there was developmental delays, and, you know, they took their sweet time putting things up, and it was because of that that Tesla started working on his idea. Well, maybe there's a way that electricity could be transmitted without the use of cables. So thanks to Edison, even though Edison never realized it, thanks to Edison, this put that spark into Tesla's head that maybe there was a better way to send electricity from where it was being generated to your house or business or anything like that.
And that's a great transition into this idea that Tesla had regarding what a lot of people think of as free electricity for everybody. That's kind of the way he described it. And he was put a lot of his energies into building a facility that never operated, but that was supposed to be designed to do exactly what you said, create abundant free electricity and deliver it in a way that didn't require electric cables. Talk a little bit about this.
Well, after the success of the power plant at Niagara Falls and the success of AC current, which, you know, made Westinghouse and Tesla a lot of money. I mean, they were extremely rich, and Tesla was rich as well. I mean, he was given royalties from, you know, I can't remember how much it was, but, you know, every volt of electricity that was generated by this facility, Tesla would get a royalty, you know, from that. So, I mean, you know, Tesla was getting a lot of money. But it still stuck with him that you could generate this electricity, but you still have to have these cables to to get them to where you needed them to go. So eventually, he moved for a while to Colorado Springs, Colorado, in around 1898, with the sole purpose of seeing. First of all, you know, he had the idea, first of all, that, you know, there could be a way that you could harness electricity from the air, from, like, thunderstorms and lightning and things like that. So Colorado Springs, due to its location, lots of thunderstorms, you know, lots of lightning, and, you know, it would be a good place to do these kinds of experiments. You know, unfortunately, you know, he was never able to make that aspect possible, you know, lightning, static electricity, almost impossible to harness. But he was also working on the idea that using a type of, and you know, we really still don't quite understand how Tesla was going to do this. He knew how, but that unfortunately has not come down to the rest of us over the years, and he perfected this idea using some kind of resonating capability, combining the Earth and the atmosphere, where you could generate electricity at its source, and then beam it basically to wherever a proper receiving array was set up. A lot of people now think that Tesla's idea was really nothing more than just putting up a big, you know, a Tesla coil into the air and just generating just a huge amount of electricity and just lightning bolts fly in every direction. Naturally, that wouldn't work because every lightning rod or TV antenna or what have you would be getting struck by this electricity, and plus it's not very efficient. It wouldn't travel very far. Yet there are still television shows being produced right now where you have these scientists and engineers saying, yeah, this is what Tesla was going to do. And, you know, they have, like, a big Tesla coil in their backyard, and they shoot lightning from it, and you know, it looks impressive, but it's not what Tesla was going to do. Unfortunately, because of the problems that Tesla had with the patent office and with other people stealing his ideas, when Tesla would make a file for a patent, he would only include just enough information to get the patent, but he wouldn't include everything, all right? And this was especially the case with his wireless electrical system. We don't know exactly. There's like, you know, you have paper A, paper D, but paper C is missing. Some of this paperwork has been discovered at the Tesla Museum in Belgrade, but unfortunately, the government officials won't allow people, or at least Western people, to examine this paperwork. You know, some people have been shown there was a show called The Tesla Files that the host of the show actually went to the museum, and the museum curator brought some of this paperwork out, allowed them to look at it, but not to take pictures or take notes or anything like that. So, you know, we only have really just like a rudimentary idea of what exactly Tesla had in mind. That being said, Tesla was certain that this was something that that would work. And with the help of, again, J.P. Morgan and some of these others who were investing in the Westinghouse company, he convinced them to allow him to build this huge transmitting array on Long Island, New York. He built this huge tower, and this was going to be his prototype. This would be the thing that he could demonstrate successfully that this would produce electricity and transmit it wirelessly to various locations. Now, Tesla's idea was that this would be something, our modern cell phone system is very similar to what Tesla's idea was, with the exception that these arrays would actually generate electricity, you know, at the locations and then transmit them, say, to the next array and then so on and so forth. Everybody in between these areas would be able then to pick up this electricity. Now, Tesla understood that his benefactors would not understand how they could profit from this system, because at this point, everybody, you know, had a very clear idea that, when electricity came by cable to your house, there'd be a meter.
Right.
You'd use that meter to record how much electricity you're using, and then, you know, you'd be charged for it. I'm sure that Tesla had ideas on how people would be charged for this, but he was fairly certain that J.P. Morgan and the others wouldn't understand this. So Tesla kind of hid a little bit what this transmitting tower was going to do. He instead said that this was going to be the first of an international radio system, wireless telephone, as he called it, that you would be able to transmit telephone signals, radio signals, all over the world, starting with this one array. Again, you know, you'd have others scattered all across the planet. Tesla even said that he'd be able to transmit television signals. I mean, they were already thinking about television in the late 19th, earliest 20th century. He kind of fudged a little bit on telling them that, yeah, and also we're going to transmit electricity to power houses without wires. So once J.P. Morgan and the others found out that this was going to be a system that also transmitted electricity, Tesla's fears were confirmed. They could not conceive how they could profit from this. If everybody was going to get electricity without cables, how are we going to make money off of it? And they pulled their funding. The Tesla Tower was only partially completed at that time. It had a dome on the top of it that was going to be covered in copper plates, and there was also a coal-driven power plant at this location. That was only partially completed as well. Unfortunately, after they pulled the money, they then sued Tesla, and then he countersued, and by that time, Tesla's name was mud. Nobody would deal with him. J.P. J.P. Morgan and the Westinghouse Company accused Tesla of being insane, that he was developing something that would never work, and if he wasn't insane, then he was a con artist. And it just, you know, for a lot of years after this debacle, nobody would hire Tesla. His newspaper accounts called him a mad scientist. There's that name again, and it's just it just totally ruined him. Even though his system more than likely would have worked, and if they had allowed him to continue with it, not only would they have become even richer, probably this planet today would be completely different than we have now.
Tim, I've got to ask you, that's quite a statement, though. This system probably would have worked, or however you phrased it. Do we have any... I guess, what do you base that on? But also, did Tesla ever demonstrate the concepts on a smaller scale to the point where you could say, okay, theoretically this can work? Or was it all just in his his paperwork in his mind?
No. Oh, he did, when he was at Colorado Springs, Colorado, he did have a number of demonstrations to show that it did that it would work. He actually put a field of electric lights about 2 or 3 miles away from his laboratory up on the mountain of Colorado Springs, and would throw the switch, and from the smaller version of his tower there at Colorado Springs, these lights would glow. Now, at first, he had trouble fine-tuning the system, because, again, it probably is working on some kind of resonating system that uses both the ground and the atmosphere. And, when his earlier experiments, it was like some of his detractors say, you had people miles away would get electric shocks when they would touch the doorknobs of their houses, right. And in fact, at one point, he accidentally blew out the generator at the Colorado Springs electric company, which Tesla kindly fixed, himself afterwards. However, After he fine-tuned this and was able to get a better understanding on the frequencies that were required for this system, it worked time and time again, but without causing an outflow, so to speak, of electricity into places that shouldn't be picking it up. Only the antennas that were erected both up in the air and into the ground would receive this electrical energy. And so, Tesla was certain that this would work on an even grander scale. You read a lot of people who have reported about this system, and they fail to mention that the transmitting tower that Tesla had put up in Long Island, New York, was not going to be the only one. Nobody really quite knows how many would be, required. Again, it's probably kind of like cell phone towers. You have them, at so many miles away from each other. It probably would have been the similar situation with the Tesla towers, but Tesla was not the kind of guy that would go and take all this money and start construction on this facility in New York if he was not certain it was going to work. That just was not the personality that he had. Talked before. He was very, had OCD or something along those lines. I mean, if this was not going to work the way he exactly intended it to, he wasn't going to continue with his research until he had perfected it. So that just tells me when he got that far to actually get funding, build the tower, almost ready to go with it, that he was certain that it was going to work exactly like it had worked out at Colorado Springs.
Well, one more question about this wireless electricity idea, and then we'll move on. Are these ideas lost to time, lost with Tesla, or have they been lost to profiteering and kind of hidden and buried because there isn't an effective way to profit from them?
I think that, okay, I don't think that it is lost completely, all right? More than likely, there has been continued research along this line, especially in the military, all right? I have heard stories from several different sources. Unfortunately, I can neither confirm or deny it, that for a number of years now, that there is a that soldiers have been issued basically like backpacks, and they'll go out to, say, you know, like out in the desert or someplace like that, or on a mission, and they set up this backpack and they put up this antenna and they receive electricity from it. They're able then to power their camp from this one machine that they don't, you know, they're not told how it works. They're just told how to operate it, you know, put it, set it up, put one antenna, you know, like ground it and put another antenna in the air, and it will provide sufficient electricity to power your camp. So I suspect that this is probably a Tesla system.
And this is something that you've been told about?
Yes, I have been told about this, like I said, from several different sources, completely independent of each other as well. You know, that's the amazing thing about it. And, you know, one gentleman, and unfortunately, you know, I can't mention their names because that would get them in very big trouble. One person just happened to talk about it out of the blue, you know, with not really knowing that I had an interest in this kind of stuff, Tesla related, not even putting two and two together that this could in any way be related to Tesla. You know, he just told me this story about how they had this wonderful thing that they were able to set up in their camp out in the middle of nowhere, and all they had to do was set it up, ground it, put an antenna up, and then it could power the entire camp. You know, now you know why I say the entire camp. I mean, you know, I'm not talking about a huge camp.
Right. Just a little encampment.
Yeah.
We have to move on because we're going to run out of time, Tim. But a great question just scrolling through our chat room here. What happened at the time? And we're going to ask this, and we're going to back up a little bit. But what happened at the time of Tesla's death with his papers and his books and his materials? There's quite a controversy over that, and some believe the government confiscated much of it. What are your thoughts, and what did you discover when you researched?
Right. Well, Tesla's final years, he spent at the New Yorker Hotel in New York, and despite the fact that people thought that he was basically penniless, I mean, he was still able to stay at this fairly nice hotel. He was receiving money from a number of different locations, but when he passed away, there, according to released FBI papers, there was a lot of concern that went as far up as the White House that that Tesla had information in his notes and papers that would be of security concern for the United States. Well, this was correct because Tesla had actually developed what he called a death beam and had tried to interest the United States in it in the late 1930s, and he was just basically ignored. He ended up actually selling it to the Soviet Union, who, you know, at that time was an ally of the United States, and apparently the Soviets were pretty happy with what they got, because a couple of years later, they gave Tesla even more money for this idea. So because of this, after he died, the FBI got the Office of Foreign Affairs, of all places, even though Tesla was a nationalized citizen, to come in and to clean out his apartment. Tesla had a safe there. He had a warehouse full of boxes and crates of his paperwork, and there was even more material that was scattered at various other locations. And you know, they tried to get a hold of everything that they possibly could, and then go through it to see if there was anything of any interest. Now, the interesting thing about all this is that President Trump's uncle was the gentleman. He was a scientist from MIT who came in to examine this material, which there was, I couldn't even begin to tell you. I mean, you know, they say that there was like maybe more than a railroad car full.
Wow.
Of boxes of material. This guy went through this material in less than 2 days and then wrote a letter saying, nothing to see, folks, nothing to see here, folks, move along. And then a lot of it just then disappeared. Some of it disappeared into the top secret files of various military laboratories. Some of it ended up at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. A lot of it in the 50s, for some reason, was released to the Tesla Museum in Belgrade. I have no idea why the United States government allowed that to happen, unless they had made copies for themselves and then just, you know, let what they thought possibly, you know, wouldn't be valuable stuff to the museum. So it's just mystifying to me. So we don't know what exactly was in this material, because there was just so much of it. But there was a lot of interest in the military to get a hold of it and to keep it secret. You would think that by now, if this stuff was of no interest, was of no scientific value. Mr. Trump said that most of the material was, as he put it, was philosophical in nature and not scientific. You would think that if this stuff was that way, that it would have been released right now. At least, yeah. You know, at least, you know, copies of it would be available. Nope, none of it. You know, some stuff from private collections, or that was discovered just by chance, you know, in somebody, you know, people's basements and attics. So like, that's all. I mean, it's just bits and pieces. So we really have no idea just exactly what kind of amazing stuff is yet to be found.
As we wind down our discussion here, we've got a few more minutes, but there's been also speculation that maybe Tesla's death wasn't entirely natural. Any ideas?
You know, it probably was. I mean, Tesla was, I mean, he was pretty old at the time. He was well into his 80s, and in fact, the previous year, he had been accidentally struck by a taxi cab when he was crossing the street. So he wasn't in the best of health. So I mean, I dare say that his death was natural. Now, the FBI was certainly keeping tabs on him because there were several agents that were embedded in the New Yorker Hotel on the floor just below where Tesla lived, that they kept their eye on him. And in fact, there are stories circulating that says that Tesla, up until the time that he died, was possibly working for the United States government for various reasons. Tesla's personal secretary, and the guy who worked with Tesla for most of his life, reported that a few days before Tesla died, that Tesla was still doing certain experiments that are still classified as top secret at a laboratory located on one of the upper levels of the New Yorker Hotel. So that was some really interesting information, considering that for years people have said that Tesla was broke and that he spent his last days just feeding pigs apart. But his personal secretary said, no, that's not true. He was still doing research and development on various projects, some of them being funded by the United States government.
Tim, you have several books here about Tesla, The Lost Journals of Nikola Tesla. Explain how your books are laid out for people.
Oh, my gosh. Well, The Lost Journals of Nikola Tesla was the first one that I wrote. I started writing it in 1999. It was released in 2001. There have been several updates to it since that time. So, I'm discovering new information all the time and adding updates. So it's probably coming due to have a new one. And believe it or not, that book has not been out of print since that time. There's still an amazing interest in that one. I've done, there was another one I did called Men of Mystery, which dealt with a guy by the name of Otis T. Carr, who in the 1950s and early 60s had developed a flying saucer type of device that he said was based on some of Tesla's anti-gravity designs. And he said that that this was going to be a device that could fly to the moon and back in just a matter of a day or so. And that's an interesting book. I wish that one had gotten a little bit more attention, because this is another guy that has kind of, people have kind of forgotten about. His device never flew because he was arrested by the government and accused of frauding of people using bad stocks and bonds and things like that. So it's a fascinating story as well.
And if we get an opportunity, do you think there will be any group of scientists, any scientific research facility that might finally crack the code here, if you will, to determine how Tesla was going to finish this project and actually be able to do what he said he was going to do with electricity being transmitted like radio waves? Do you think there's a group of scientists that'll actually be able to figure this one out?
Well, I think so. It's just a matter of whether or not my earlier stories about possible military development of these ideas, if you have a laboratory that comes up with something similar, they may run into a roadblock because the military or a laboratory, supporting laboratory, may have already issued patents along these lines, and they'll find that they can't issue a patent for what they're working on, or even more frightening, they'll find that all of a sudden the men in black are knocking on the door saying, you can't go any further with this.
Right.
It's top secret.
Yeah. One more chat question that I find curious, and I don't know what the meaning is to this question. You hopefully will, Tim. But the question is, has Tim reached out to Bob Lazar about any pages or research he knows of Tesla?
I've talked to Bob Lazar, but... Luzar has never really talked that much about Tesla, and I know where they're going with this. As far as I know, Luzar has never talked or expressed that much interest, in Tesla's work. And again, it may be a situation where, coinciding developments of technology, the people may not realize that they are working or developing something that Tesla had been working on, or even had gone as far as to have a patent issued 100 years ago.
Well, it's a great discussion, as always, Tim. I'm glad you agreed to come back and have this conversation with us, because Tesla is a fascinating character, and I think as time goes on, we'll start to understand him a little bit better. He remained such an enigma for so long, and I think we're starting to, some of those clouds are starting to part, and we're starting to get a handle on who this guy was.
Yeah, it's I'm always interested to hear new people coming out and saying, "Oh my gosh, I just discovered this guy Nikola Tesla and all the wonderful things that he's done." So yeah, I mean, as years go by, it's just it's heartwarming for me to see his name just getting out there more and more.
Well, your work in both the books you've written plus appearances on shows like this helps get that word out. So, Tim, thanks so much. Look forward to having you back again real soon.
My pleasure. I had a great time tonight, and I hope your audience enjoyed it as well.
Beyond Reality Paranormal is hosted by J.V. Johnson and produced by Orion Palmer and Slick Eddie Edwards. Like us on Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Please consider supporting the program either through your podcast platform, click on the link in the description, or on Patreon at Joha Productions. If you'd like to be a guest on Beyond Reality Paranormal, or you have a recommendation for a guest, contact our producer, Slick Eddie Edwards. Eddie is spelled with a Y, at slickeddieedwards@gmail.com.